Good afternoon. Call this hearing to order. This is a resumption of the hearings on the stage one of the proposed district plan for Queenstown Lakes District. This is, of course, stream 12, the upper Cleaver monitoring. And I think everybody probably knows who it is, but for the record, I'm accompanied on my right by Commissioner Jenny Hudson. Next to her, Commissioner Callum McLeod. To my left, Commissioner Ian Moran. I'm Trevor Robinson, Chair of this hearing. Not all commissioners are going to be present at all times. We're going to mix and match a little. So Commissioner Munro will be present for the first 3 weeks of the hearing, reflecting his interest in urban and urban fringe issues. Commissioner Hudson will be here this week, not next week, but then the weeks three through five. In effect, that will mean that she will be hearing urban fringe and rural issues. Commissioner McLeod will get a day off on the 30th of May due to a personal conflict he has with the issues raised in the submissions of Marina Proprietary and Sneaky Curlew, but will otherwise be present throughout, as I will be. I think the hearing schedule has been circulated. We'll try and stick close to that, but not right on it. If we're going to run over or run short, that's not the end of the world. Look to you for guidance on that, Ms. Scott. I think we only have the council team present. Can't sell tickets. Ms. Scott, over to you. We've all read your legal submissions, so I'd be grateful if you didn't read them back to us. But please identify any and all issues you want to highlight, and we'll go from there.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. I thought I'd just start by pointing you to the information that we have filed in advance of this hearing, just to make sure we're all aware of what we have. The Council has filed a Council bundle and supplementary bundle, and the Council's evidence refers to that throughout. Included in that Council bundle, as well as a number of technical reports, is the Council's position on the text of the proposed district plan through the course of the earlier hearing streams 1 to 10. Also included in there is its evidence, both of a planning nature and technical nature where relevant, that has been filed in earlier hearings. I have two documents I would like to hand out. The first is a list of the submissions that Mr. Barr recommends to be accepted or accepted in part. So this is in terms of the position he has reached at this point in time following filing of his rebuttal evidence. I thought that would be useful for you and all parties involved. Just to be clear, it doesn't include his recommendations on those submissions who are simply seeking that the notified zone be confirmed. I have a second document here, and this is an additional schedule to my legal submission. You may have noticed that Appendix 1 refers to a schedule. It is simply an extract from the Colonial Vineyard case, paragraph 17. I just wanted to ensure that that was complete. That was missing from the copy that was filed. My apologies. You may have noticed a big map up on the wall to your left. This map has been provided by Mr. Glasner. It is not part of this evidence, and it is focused solely on Wanaka. But the purpose of that was to allow council officers and experts and or submitters to point you to necessary parts of the district if necessary. That planning map also shows the water and wastewater scheme boundaries, which are referred to in Mr. Glasner's evidence. Mr. Grayson will be called tomorrow and he can speak to that tiny map if you wish. Also in front of you, so in terms of the council's evidence, Mr. Barr has filed a strategic statement of evidence which does take you through the council's position on some of the relevant chapters, in particular chapters 3, 4 and 6 of the proposed district plan, also the rural chapter in 21. It also talks about relevant higher order documents and the like. Also in front of you is the evidence in chief and then there is supplementary evidence filed on behalf of Mr. Barr and Mr. Osborne that relates to dwelling capacity, and then there is the council's rebuttal evidence. In terms of the council's rebuttal evidence, it of course only covers matters that are new or that are new in relation to evidence that's been filed by submitters. It doesn't seek to just state the same as what it has in its evidence in chief. So just because rebuttal is silent on some submitted expert evidence doesn't mean that we are in agreement with that expert.
Silence does not equal acceptance.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Dr. Reed's, Ms. Halsop's summary statement, it's come to our attention that there is a figure missing from it. That is the figure that's been requested by the panel that shows the O&L line on Lake Mackay Station going over into the neighbouring district. A copy is on its way. Apologies in printing this morning, that is one thing that's been missed, but it will be provided to you shortly, and a hard copy has been filed with the support staff. Mr. Chair, just before I actually get into the submissions, I thought I would perhaps ask you or seek some guidance on how you intend to work through the various rezoning submissions. I understand there's around 116 of them. Clearly the council's evidence addresses all of them. And given the extent of evidence that has to be filed, of course the council's highlight summaries don't take you through all of them. I have directed the council's witnesses to focus where they can on those rezonings that have been addressed in their rebuttal evidence. So essentially where submitters have filed expert evidence. I'm of course in your hands how you like to deal with that, but I guess my point is the highlight packages are just very high level given the extent of what they have to cover. And we have at times had to breach the directions of a 2-page limit. My apologies, I take full responsibility for that. And that is to do with the scope of what we need to cover. And we of course are presenting the council's case in 1 week, you know, where other submitters have an entire day for one area of land. So in your hands on how you want to work through the rezoning, but some guidance on that would be appreciated if you've given it some thought.
Yes, we have. I think that we don't need council witnesses to focus in summary on those submitters for whom no evidence has been called. It may be that I or other commissioners may have questions on those aspects of the evidence, but it's only if we have questions that we will seek your council witnesses' assistance on those submitters, and like you, we propose to focus on those submitters who have called evidence the exception, and there may be no one in this category. I haven't checked. Obviously, a number of submitters have filed extensive reasons for their submissions, some including technical reports supporting their submission. We'll have to consider those in greater detail, because if there are any in that category who haven't also called the evidence, we'll have to obviously give that greater consideration, which means a corresponding interest in what the staff may have to say about those submissions.
So thank you, that's understood and that's helpful.
And before you get underway, while you're talking about information, I have got a small list of my own of extra information I'd be grateful if you or your team could provide. The first is that the Jeremy Bell witnesses, specifically Mr. Brown, refers to an Austral report that Mr. Barr also discusses. Can we have a copy of that report, please, because it's not in the supplementary documents? Well, not if it is, I couldn't find it. Secondly, Dr. Reed has produced some additional Glendu Bay figures with her rebuttal evidence. I'd be grateful if between she or you, we could be provided, before she gives evidence, with a copy of her Appendix 2, which is the Glendu Bay Covenant map, with the updated and revised Glendu Bay structure plan overlaid on. I'm interested to see the interrelationship between the covenant boundaries and the area boundaries under the new zone, and if at the same time we could have, please, a one page or however many pages it takes to reproduce the covenants that are applicable for each area. Obviously they're in the consent conditions, but for easy reference I'd like to be able to look at the plan with the covenants alongside them.
Yes, we can look to do that. I suspect that might be information for tomorrow.
but I thought I'd raise it now to get to you. Are there any other requests? Anyone feel they don't have enough paper?
I have sufficient paper.
Commissioner McLeod, that's sufficient paper. Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you. Just in respect of the Barina submission relating to the overlay, both the submitter's expert and Ms. Jones talk about and refer to cross-sections taken from the Wanaka Town Centre guideline that, again, I didn't see in the bundle or supplementary bundle.
Thank you. We will get a copy of that for you. Our final comment on the information and evidence that's been filed. In terms of the summaries that will be provided to you, my experience in earlier rezoning hearings in front of this panel, or just the constituted panels, we have been slightly surprised that the witnesses dealing with just one site are taking a reasonably wide latitude in terms of presenting a summary of their written evidence. Obviously, hearing procedures is entirely in your hands, Mr. Chair. And that is a matter for the panel, but the council simply cannot replicate that amount of detail in its summaries, and I just wish to draw that to your attention.
On the other hand, having set a precedent, the length of summaries, I think that we'd be duty bound to allow the submitters, but for my part, summaries are just that. I'm more interested in the details sitting behind them, the summaries that have assisted us to get our heads or headspace in the correct submission and the correct area of land.
Thank you, sir. And in terms of the order that the council witnesses will be called, we're going to need to be a little bit flexible depending on how long we take and people's availability. I just have one issue today. Well, it's not an issue, but Mr. Faulkner, he is only available to present evidence to you this afternoon between around 4 and 5 p.m. So we are just going to have to work around that. He is on a plane to China tomorrow, and he is at another meeting right now. So just foreshadowing that. So turning to my written legal submissions. I will just take you to some of the key points, sir, given that the panel has read them. At paragraph 1.4, I just confirmed there that the written submissions address key legal submissions that have been raised in the course of preparing for this hearing. So in terms of submissions and evidence filed by submitters, they do not address the council's position on each and every rezoning. And given the number and breadth of rezoning submissions before the panel, it is anticipated that additional legal issues will arise that will need to be addressed in the council's reply. We will also take direction from the panel in terms of questions they ask of submitters during the course of the hearing. But as to what needs to be covered in the council's legal reply, I just note there, perhaps more for the purpose of submitters than the panel, but just because submission hasn't been mentioned or has been mentioned in these legal submissions does not mean that the council has focused more or less on that particular rezoning. I think we've covered paragraph 1.5. At section 2 of these submissions, I have set out a strategic overview. I mentioned that Mr. Barr has filed a strategic statement of evidence, and this strategic overview follows from Mr. Barr's particular statement. So the Council's approach is embedded within the objectives and policies of the strategic directions chapter in the statutory framework under the RMA. Council's objective is to ensure urban development occurs in a logical manner that promotes a compact, well-designed and integrated form, manages the cost of infrastructure and protects the district's rural landscapes from sporadic and sprawling development. The strategic and integrated management of urban growth in Wanaka involves the use of an urban growth boundary. Although this is a new concept in the proposed district plan, it was introduced into the Wanaka 2020 and Wanaka Structure Plan 2007 documents. And the intention and the purpose of the UGB is to enable and intensify development within those boundaries, coordinate and integrate development, and discourage urban development outside of them. On the other hand, the finite capacity of rural areas to absorb residential development must be considered so as to protect the qualities of the district's landscapes. And you will hear evidence from Dr. Reid and Ms. Malsop in relation to protection of the ONLs and ONS within the basin. So this approach from Chapter 3 has fed through to Chapter 4, which is the urban development chapter of the PUP. Chapter 4 addresses key urban growth management issues and sets out the tools for managing the spatial location and layout of urban development. In paragraph 2.4, I mention Mr. Glasner's evidence, which is important in that he has assessed the rezoning submissions in terms of their impact on infrastructure networks. It's important that new development takes place in a coordinated and integrated way, and his evidence is that it is much more efficient to service new developments where capacity already exists, and that it is not in the council's best interest for its water and wastewater networks to extend further into currently zoned rural land outside the urban limits, as this will result in increased operational maintenance and renewal costs for the council over the long term.
Scott, I have a question arising from that, because this is a point that some of the planning witnesses have canvassed. Is it your submission that the ability of current or planned future infrastructure to service the demand from particular sites, or the inability of it to service particular sites, is determinative of the application for rezoning? That's the first question. And the follow-up is, if it is, tell me why.
The answer to your first question is yes, except for certain zones where on-site infrastructure is anticipated. The reason why is that the council is assessing the rezonings in respect of the capacity. So there is once land is rezoned, there's an expectation that it be connected to the council's infrastructure. If there isn't capacity within the existing infrastructure, then there needs to be upgrades. Where an upgrade is included in the council's LTP, the council has acknowledged that and says that it is planned, and Mr. Glasner has said that's okay in terms of the rezoning. It's where there is no ability to connect to the council's infrastructure, where there's no capacity, that the council has issues with that. Related to that is the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity, which requires the council to provide sufficient capacity over the short, medium and long term. What it also requires is that new developments or rezoning, it requires that that the infrastructure be feasible. Apologies, I think I put the wording wrong here. But the infrastructure, basically once it's rezoned, the NPS is suggesting that the council will need to fund infrastructure for that new area of land. Council's budgets are obviously not limited, and Mr. Glasner speaks to that in his evidence. So it needs to...
I think you did in the reverse.
Sorry, sir?
You said council's budgets are not limited.
Oh, they are limited, sir. Yeah, I do need the reverse, clearly. Sorry. Yes, thank you for that correction. And also related to that is his evidence about how there are more efficient ways to use infrastructure from a technical perspective.
So, summarising my understanding of that, previously there was an expectation, and I was, as you were telling me that, my next question was going to be where does that expectation come from? But you're saying that this is in the NPS. Can you refer me to the policy or provision of the NPS which sees that, please?
Yes, it's just not just the NPS that I'm referring to. It is the relationship between the RMA and the LGA that is addressed in both Mr. Barr's strategic evidence or Mr. Glasner's evidence, where he talks about the reasons why it needs to take an integrated approach to land use planning. In policy PA1 in the National Policy Statement, this talks about short, medium and long term housing and business land development capacity. It talks about in the short term development capacity must be feasible, zoned and serviced with development infrastructure. As you move to medium and long term, the requirements as to serviceability changes. The medium term talks about the funding for the development infrastructure required to service that development capacity must be identified in a long-term plan required under the Local Government Act. And it is the long-term plan that Mr. Krasner has referred to in his evidence when he is considering whether infrastructure for a certain new area is anticipated or whether planned upgrades are planned. And then in the long term it talks about identifying it in a relevant infrastructure strategy rather than in the long-term plan. So that is part of the link in terms of the approach that Mr. Glasner has taken. Of course, the NPS is a reasonably new document. It hasn't been around for some time, but what it does is place or ups the ante in terms of the council's planning for ensuring that it has sufficient development capacity within its district.
I think that where that takes me is that there's a chicken and egg situation here, but your submission is if there is a rezoning, then either in the medium or the long term, the NPS requires infrastructure services to be provided to meet that demand. Is that your submission?
It's related to the level, so the council needs to provide a sufficient level of capacity to meet demand under the NPS. And in the short term, the estimated, the amount that is provided needs to be serviceable. That is a slightly different concept in terms of whether you simply rezone land, whether it can be serviceable or not. But a lot of the evidence filed by submitters comes back to the NPS and uses it as a reason as to why the council should be releasing it for residential use. And they're saying because you need more capacity and you need more housing choice, generally the two things coming through.
And while we're on that subject, in the memorandum you filed discussing whether the plan gives effect to the NPS or the extent to which you expressed the view that the Wanaka urban environment equates to the Wanaka ward, at least that's my recollection of your memorandum, and it may be that you just took that into account for convenience in terms of the population calculations. But I wanted to ask, I wanted to test that proposition because we're also faced with arguments on behalf of submitters that the NPS requires the plan to provide for demand for housing in rural areas, which was, I found, a novel concept, but it occurred to me that those submissions could find support in your own memorandum, and I just wanted to be clear on what the council's position is on what are the relevant urban environments and to what extent does the NPS govern the position outside those urban environments.
Yes, so this is a complicated area. I believe the word, the Wanaka ward term is used in the evidence of Mr. Osborne, and it relates to the dwelling capacity model. And it is a term used to potentially describe this side of the hill and the other side of the hill, so the Queenstown ward, the Wanaka ward. In my memorandum of council, where we were asked to address the urban environment and what forms part of the urban environment, we take a step back. The NPS uses two different concepts. One is an urban environment, and the definition of an urban environment in the NPS essentially talks about concentrated settlements, and the definition is specific to the NPS. It doesn't take you anywhere else. The NPS also talks about an urban area. The definition of urban area takes you to the Statistics New Zealand definition. So they are two different things and they are not one and the same when you come to actually applying it on the ground. So in terms of the urban environment, this is the memorandum dated 19th of April, where the council's position is that the Wanaka urban environment includes Wanaka, Albertown, Luggett and Hawea. That is a different, so the first set of, so the objectives in the NPS and the first set of policies, so PA1, through to PA4 apply to urban environments and in respect of the policies, urban environments that are expected to experience growth. When you then turn to the remainder of the NPS, it talks about urban areas, and this is where you go to Statistics New Zealand. Statistics New Zealand defines Hawea and Wanaka as separate urban areas.
don't think it defines luggage at all, does it?
Luggage, I believe, and I stand to be corrected, sits within Hawea in terms of the map that you can find if you spend some time searching around Statistics New Zealand's website. So what the Statistics New Zealand definitions do, they do not align with what is considered to be an urban environment when you look at the definition that the NTS uses. Then there are the urban growth boundaries in Wanaka. And of course,
Before you go on, can you just clarify the point you said that Luggett is included in Hawea? Is all of the countryside between Luggett and Hawea included in Hawea as well?
No, sir. So it's the residential areas contained within. And the reasons for that are set out in the supplementary memorandum. And it's that they function as the same concentrated settlement as Wanaka. And the same as for Hawea. So there is no concentrated shopping area within Hawea, for example. They go to Wanaka for those types of experiences. The Queenstown District is somewhat complicated when it comes to applying this NPS. It's quite simple when you look at Christchurch or maybe Auckland, but in Queenstown, because of the pattern of urban settlement, around the likes of the mountains and the lakes and the rivers, it's somewhat more complex.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. And then, so when you hear evidence from Ms. Hanson on behalf of Samita Beresford, her evidence then goes into whether there is sufficient. So the council's position is that there is sufficient capacity. She then accepts that there is sufficient capacity within the urban growth boundary, so she takes that next step. But then she talks about whether it is the right type of capacity. So that will come quite late in the hearing, I think. But that is where the concept of the urban growth boundary comes to. And Mr. Osborne will speak to you about the Wanaka Ward and as well as capacity within the urban growth boundary.
Can I, before you go on, just take you back a few minutes to your answers for the chair's questions. And just be sure I'm also on the same page as yourself and the chair. My understanding of the NPS is that short term is 3 years, the next 3 years. Medium term is 3 to 10 years, and long term is 10 to 30 years. And the district plan notionally has a life of around 10 years. So I'm not understanding why you drew reference to the short-term feasible zone and service of infrastructure when that, I'm not seeing how that at all needs to apply to land that might be zoned within a 10-year plan. It might just be that only that proportion needed for short-term purposes actually. That might be what you're saying, but I wasn't clear what you were saying.
Yes, I accept what you're saying. So clearly the life of the plan is 10
yes.
years.
And is it fair to say that any council, because no council has a money tree that I'm aware of, certainly not when it comes to paying my fees, no council is going to, in its LTP program, massive infrastructure upgrades up to a paddock that it has not otherwise identified of itself for growth, would it?
No.
So that inevitably means any submitter seeking a rezoning will find themselves faced with, but they're not in an LTP. That wouldn't seem to me to be a fair and reasonable barrier to put in front of submitters, would it? I don't think you're saying that, but I just want to be clear how the LGA, LTP, may be used unintentionally as a roadblock to stop submitters and only let the council decide where zones should go, because it
that does LTP. No, I'm not, and there are rezonings before you which are located sufficiently close to existing infrastructure and that,
yep.
that can be joined.
That's fine, you clarified. So, right up to the very first question you were asked by the chair, that was about infrastructure as a requisite to rezoning. As I read the proposed plan, seems to me that were we to agree with all of the rezoning requests, just for the sake of argument, there's virtually no permitted activities that could occur because they all need extensive subdivision. And subdivision is all restricted discretionary, and there's a proposed restriction of discretion specifically relating to infrastructure. So it would seem to me that the plan as written does provide for the council to refuse developments in zoned areas on the basis of inadequate infrastructure being in place. Have I read something wrong there?
No, I don't think you have.
But it's the council's view that it's still preferable to not provide zoning, even though there are consent safeguards, if the council's view is that it's too hard slash way outside the realms of what it thinks it could achieve. In terms of expectation management, I think you are.
Yeah, well, rezoning provides a clear and obvious expectation that that land will be developed at the density that it's rezoned to. If there's no ability, or if the council has no intention to provide that infrastructure, there's going to be probably extreme political pressure for it to find some funding somewhere in its coffers and build the infrastructure. It could be doing that in all directions around Wanaka and Hawea.
Yeah, I understand that. I just want to be clear on the legal basis for making it easier for the council to say no to people. Because, as you say, political pressure might come up. Well, maybe that just means the council has to do a better job of saying no. But I'm not sure of the extent to which the plan might be being used as a crutch in that respect. One argument for zoning is that you identify the land use that's most appropriate to the land. And just holding things in rural might not actually be justifiable or defendable if rural is not regarded as the optimal or best use of land. Is that a fair risk or concern in my mind, or do you think I'm overthinking it?
I don't think you are overthinking it. I mean, that the test for the panel is what is the most appropriate zoning for this land, and this is one of the matters that feeds into to the recommendations that are being made.
Do you think the PDP across all of its provisions, strategic to zone-wide, to land use, to subdivision, as the case may be, or definitions, has sufficient clarity to manage expectations, such as just because you've got a zone doesn't mean the council is going to give you free infrastructure? Does the plan not clearly close off that expectation that the council is concerned with? And if not, should it? And if so, do we have scope to do so?
I don't know the answer to that question without going back and looking at the provisions again. Your second question, possibly yes, as to scope, I don't know the answer to that either. But there is sufficient, there is, you know, extensive scope, particularly in terms of the rural zone, about where we go.
One answer might be that this panel doesn't have scope because it's dealing with that report.
Yes, that is the case. I guess I'm sitting here with a wider view in mind in terms of the wider review, but I think that corrects there in terms of the recommendations that can be made by this panel. Take the questions on board, and I will speak to Mr. Barr about that before you hear from him later in the week.
Yeah, I think I'd be very interested in terms of just that general discussion, specifically to understand whether the subdivision restrictions of discretion relating to infrastructure were envisaged by the council to allow it to fundamentally refuse development on land until funding and LTPs, etc., has been made available, or whether it was really just focusing on what you might call the detailed infrastructure for a given subdivision, where the manhole goes, which side of the road the pipes go on, that sort of thing. It could be either or both of those, but it certainly isn't clear to me.
Thank you.
My recollection, having sat on the subdivision hearing, is that it's much more the latter. It's about infrastructure from the edge of a development to the individual properties. That's my recollection.
Well, look, some clarification there would be helpful in thinking about the different zones there is.
Yes, my correction is my recollection is also the latter, but we will go back and look at that for you.
Thank you.
after that extended interruption at paragraph 2.4. Maybe you can discuss.
Yes, so I was at chapter 4 of the proposed district plan. So taking you through the various policy directions within the urban development chapter. Turning to page 4, of relevance to the Upper Clutha is that chapter 4, the distinction between urban and rural areas, that is maintained to protect the quality and character of the environment and visual amenity. Ad hoc development of rural land is avoided. ONLs and ONS are protected from encroachment by urban development. Development supports increased density through greenfield and infill development in appropriate locations to avoid sprawling into surrounding rural areas. And rural land outside of the urban growth boundary is not developed until further investigations indicate that more land is needed to meet demand. I then turn to chapter 6, which is of course the landscape chapter, which expands on strategic objective 3.2.5.1, which seeks to protect the ONLs and ONS from inappropriate subdivision use and development. In paragraph 2.7, I just mentioned there that the rest of the rural zone, which is not classified as an ONL or ONS, is classified as a rural landscape, which has varying types of landscape character and amenity values. Specific policy and assessment measures are also provided to manage the potential effects of subdivision and development in these locations. The rural chapter 21, the policies of that chapter seek to ensure that growth can be accommodated in a sustainable way that does not have significant impacts on the natural values that draw people to the area and drive the local economy. It is the rural chapter where you'll find the detailed landscape assessment measures for the three landscape classifications as well. So that overall, the council's approach to the rezoning submissions is based firmly on the strategic approach to urban development, as set out in the strategic directions chapter and the PDP as a whole. The strategic directions chapter provides the overarching direction for the other chapters within the plan and sets out high-level strategic objectives and policies for each of the 7 goals listed. This hierarchy within the plan means that the zones and their associated rules need to achieve the relevant zones, objectives and policies, which in turn need to achieve the higher order objectives and policies as set out in the strategic directions chapter. Turning to dwelling capacity, we have already touched on this and the memoranda that is before the panel. I just wish to add there that Ms Hanson's evidence on dwelling capacity was received just before these written submissions were filed and will be addressed during the course of the council's case by its experts. In reading Ms Hanson's evidence, I do draw you to her paragraph 7.1, which is the start of his conclusion, and I'll just read it in full. Mr Barr and Ms Osborne conclude the following. The findings of the DCM identify that there is adequate feasible residential development capacity within the Upper Clutha area to provide for projected growth in the short, medium and long term as defined in the NPS. Taking into account my dwelling projections and the amendments to the DCM in 2017 that occurred after Mr Barr's and Mr Osborne's evidence, I consider this statement is still applicable. So essentially, Ms Hanson is agreeing with the council's evidence in terms of there being sufficient development capacity. Otherwise, I'll leave Mr Osborne to address you on that evidence. Turning to paragraph 2.14, the statutory test for rezoning, just very briefly, I have adopted submissions that have been presented in earlier hearings here, but what ultimately the test for the panel is for each rezoning or annotation change that has been pursued, the question before the panel is what is the most appropriate zoning or location of the line for the area in question. The outcome must achieve the relevant objectives of the proposed district plan, including the strategic direction objectives that provide the overarching direction. The council and subsequently the panel must have regard to the actual or potential effects on the environment of any activities that would apply through the application of a rule within a rezoning request. Submitters need to provide a level of detail that corresponds to the scale and significance of the environmental effects that are anticipated from the implementation of the new zone, and that comes from section 32. And in the council submission, need to provide sufficient evidence to assist the panel in considering whether actual or potential adverse effects are satisfactory before it makes a recommendation that the zone is more appropriate than the notified zone. Just referring here, we have touched on this. The council generally does not support rezoning for a reason advanced as to why the rezoning is more appropriate is reliance on a matter of discretion or control being sufficient to assess adverse effects at the consent application stage. It's submitted that such an approach does not correspond with the requirements of section 32.1c and may otherwise undermine the Colonial Vineyards approach.
Scott, just ask you to pause there and ask you a rhetorical question that occurred to me when I read that aspect of your submissions. If a rule in the plan, and this is really the discussion we've already had about infrastructure is really a case example. If a rule in the plan provides a discretion that is sufficiently wide and enables refusal of consent, let's just take traffic as an example, but allows the consent to be refused on traffic grounds, can you really say that traffic is an adverse effect of rezoning? And if you can say that, can you explain it to me? Because I suppose I'm not understanding the point.
I think, sir, that it's the level of detail that Section 32 requires that you provide a level of detail that corresponds to the scale and significance of the environmental effects that are anticipated from the implementation of the new zone. So that is, in terms of your example with transport, it is the likely effects on the transport network, and in addition, I think Ms. Banks also talks about some safety concerns that she has that may arise from the implementation of the new zone. The council's position is section 32 requires the panel to consider that matter now rather than simply saying, well, the council can decline the consent later on, so we don't need to bother with it.
I suppose the key issue for me is, what question do we need to be asking ourselves, taking the transport question? Is the question, are the likely level of effects able to be managed within the scope of the rules in that zone? Or because some of the planning evidence the council says it's not certain, but Mr. Barr is more hedged and says it's not sufficiently certain, which is possibly a wiser place for him to be. What would your submission be on the legal basis that we have to ask? What is the question that we need to be asking ourselves in that case? What does the evidence have to be directed at? What does it have to satisfy us of? And by all means, use an example, because that's a very general question.
Well, the written submissions are here that the panel needs to consider whether the actual or potential adverse effects are satisfactory, which is, I accept, quite a general submission. But it's, from the council's perspective, it's about there being a solution available within the scope of the rezoning, in terms of, as an example, site access. And there are some rezonings where there is no information provided with the submission or in evidence as to how or where there might be access to the site. So the council's not saying we need a structure plan or anything in the PDP which requires the exact location of the access to this area. It's saying that it needs to be satisfied that if the rezoning goes through, that there won't be any actual or potential adverse effects. And I use those words because they come from Section 32 of RMA.
Well, I suppose, is that putting it too strong? Because if there were no actual or potential adverse effects, everything would be permitted.
Yes.
Having, as you have across the plan reviewed the council's PDP, are you satisfied that the council itself has adhered to the standard you're recommending to us when it has proposed to change zones from what they might, the equivalent of the ODP might be, such that if we were to agree with the submission and refuse or recommend refusal for some submissions on the basis of uncertain resolution of where access might be, and then that submitter went to court and showed 50 examples of the council's own rezonings where it hadn't provided any documentary evidence of such a consideration. It's got to be a two-way street, surely. So are you satisfied that the council has, in every instance of the proposed rezonings, achieved that level?
I'm not sure I can answer that question. Are you asking in respect of any change in zonings from the ODP across to the PDP?
Yeah, I think that would be the one. I think if the council is suggesting the test is X, then surely it would be in a position of saying it has met that test on itself. And I'm just questioning whether in fact that is the case that the council is asserting.
Yes, in terms of the... I can't speak to every change in zoning between the ODP and the PDP, whether there's been any upzoning. I'm not aware of that, unless they are ones that are actually specifically being addressed through
sure.
a rezoning and submission that is before you.
Sure. Well, like I think the key issue from my perspective to think on is I'm very mindful to be sure that the council does not enjoy any preferential consideration in what it would like to see happen. And I think it's pretty clear that that's not something this panel is supposed to be encouraging.
Yes, I understand that. So, paragraph 2.18, I refer there to the King Salmon case. The purpose of that is simply to point out that in this hearing, in terms of the higher order documents that this proposed plan needs to give effect to, we have the Otago Regional Policy Statement. It is currently under review, but I guess the key point is that the relevant objectives have been identified in Mr. Barr's strategic evidence, and none of these are highly specific nor directive in the King Salmon sense in relation to the issues at hand. The King Salmon principle depends on the particular wording of the higher order national planning documents. And the regional policy statement is generally not worded in the same manner as the New Zealand coastal policy statement. Consequently, the King Salmon principle is not binding on the panel. It is both permissible and appropriate that the panel has regard to part two in its evaluation of relief.
Question from you, Scott. I understand the argument you're making on King Salmon, but has that not been overtaken by Plum Point Station and Davidson, which relied on Plum Point Station and leveraged it off into resource consents? Well, just to be clear, the ratio I took from Plum Point was when you get to rules, you can't reopen rules on a part two basis because rules have to give effect to objectives. So overview.
Yes, well, in the instance of the proposed district plan, we do not have established objectives and policies. They are all up for grabs through this process. And we, of course, do not have recommendations or a decision of the panel on what the proposed district plan objectives and policies shall be. So we are working in a different environment to what we might be in if this was, for example, a plan change and the objectives and policies in the plan were already established. They were certain. They were not up for grabs. They were not. They were beyond appeal. So we are in a quite a different situation in this instance.
That troubles me because I'm thinking that the logical place that's going to take us is that if we are satisfied on the evidence before this panel that Ann Beresford is clearly the one where part two considerations come into play most sharply, that's the one that appears to my mind at any rate, that if we were to say on a part two basis that, for instance, there should be a rezoning of sticky forest land, for argument's sake, on a part two basis, and that is then out of step with the objectives of the plan, both as recommended to us by council staff and as the relevant hearing panel earlier on the PDP process would recommend those objectives to be. Isn't that a problem? Given that the ultimate section 32 test is what is the most appropriate way to give effect to the objectives.
I think that's a more a matter of process in terms of the hearings that are being rolled out on this plan review and the fact that recommendations have been made on, for example, the strategic objectives in an earlier hearing. And we're now here making recommendations on the rezoning. We have discussed with the chair of a separate panel a concept where any recommendations on rezonings that require or may require changes to the text need to be made to the earlier hearings panel. That they could take into account. That is a matter of process rather than the legal test, I think. The council has used its reply version of the objectives and policies, for example, of the rural chapter, in making its recommendations. Because we don't have a decision on them, it does leave us all in a bit of an awkward place. And I know that some submitters will come along and submit to you later saying, well, they're not our version of the objectives and policies, they're just the council's version, so I'm going to talk to you about my version. Unfortunately, that's just the fact of this process, and I'm not sure I can
I think
find a solution there, sir, for you.
I think what you're telling me, though, is that if we get ourselves to that position, we need to communicate that to the relevant stream on the text, saying they need to think again.
That is correct, sir. And in respect of Beresford, I suspect that legal counsel will be arguing that resorting to part two is appropriate, and I think we're completely aligned on that. So I suspect there'll be no difference in opinion.
Can I ask a follow-up on that distinction? Just maybe coming back to it later on. I was interested in a more explicit confirmation of the council's position to us in respect of how we should be approaching the rezoning requests, specifically in terms of section 32. Specifically in terms of whether or not each zone can be seen as a method to implement the strategic objectives of the plan, and on that basis whether for section 32 purposes we should only be considering different rezoning alternatives in light of those objectives that they would be implementing as methods. or whether or not we treat the zones, because each zone does have its own objectives, whether we should be considering alternative zone objectives directly against part two. So what I'm asking is for some guidance on how the council sees the different zone alternatives in light of the two different varieties of 32, where objectives are against part two and everything else is against objectives. But it may well be that the position the chair put to you about considering submissions for different rezones against part two directly might not even be the appropriate thing for us to do. Mr. Barr, for instance, described the zones as methods to achieve the strategic parts of the plan. And if that's the council's view, that might lead the council to propose a particular pathway to us. But now I've just heard you say that in fact we should be considering the submissions directly against part two, which tells me that they can't be seen as alternative methods, as bundles to achieve the strategic objectives, because that section 32 scenario doesn't include a part two analysis, it just stops at the objectives that the implementing, doesn't it? Maybe that's something just to think about and get back to us on. Because I'm very keen to have a clear, consistent, uniform way of assessing the rezoning requests.
Yes. I might take the opportunity to come back to you on that. One point I do just wish to make, and I think I've touched on this earlier, is that the rules within a particular zone type, they do need to achieve the objectives and policies within that zone, but they also need to achieve the objectives and strategic objectives.
Agreed.
So there's two
objectives. But this hearing isn't about deciding what those rules and objectives should be, it's about deciding which of the toolboxes is the right fit. So
yes.
That's what I'm not clear on.
Yes, but the council, in making a recommendation as to a particular zone, has taken those objectives and policies into account. It hasn't simply ignored, for example, the rural lifestyle objectives and policies.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting whether for the purpose of this hearing, even though each zone has its own objectives, policies and methods for its internal administration and the outcomes it seeks, whether we are in fact, as Mr. Barr suggested, whether we should be seeing them as alternative methods to achieve this list. Almost I'm suggesting there might be different tiers of objectives in the plan, which I think the council is effectively saying.
Yes, that's correct. That is. And just I think to add to the complexity there is that there are some submitters who are seeking zone-specific provisions, which they are submitting will assist in terms of that zone being appropriate for their area of land, which is expected and anticipated through planning.
Yeah, it leads on for me to a later question about things like regional policy statements, for instance. Same principle would apply. If we're really just looking at alternative methods to implement the strategic directions, and King Salmon to some extent applies, do the strategic directions themselves not already deal with RPS type considerations? Because some submitters are saying yes, some submitters are saying no, some submitters are ignoring all the criteria the council came up with, the staff came up with, and are looking directly to those external forces, and it would be helpful to have a more reasoned way of resolving all that.
Yes, okay. We'll come back to you on that. Thank you.
Scott, I think that we will need, given that we'll be starting with submitters next week, we're going to need that guidance by the end of this week.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. Okay, so back to the written legal submissions. Look, at paragraph 2.22, I just refer to the definitions chapter. This is just a reminder that for any new specific zones that are being pursued or any new site-specific rules, that the proposed district plan definitions in Chapter 2 will apply whenever a defined term is used in the proposed district plan, unless the context otherwise requires. That's just a reminder, as that it seems to get forgotten as we work through these processes, and we don't want that to become an issue later on. Just in section 3, to quickly address you on some matters which have come from other hearings. This is really just for context for those that were not involved. The first relates to the local shopping centre zone located on Cadrona Valley Road. Four separate submissions were heard in the business hearing stream. it became fairly evident during the course of that hearing that they need to be considered alongside a rezoning submission, so they are before you for your recommendation. And then in paragraph 3.4, I just mentioned there that the panel earlier in this process directed that submission seeking to alter the boundaries of SNAs should be heard within this hearing, and that direction means that any submission seeking that any SNAs that be removed completely were to be heard in the earlier hearing stream. In section 4, so some of the rezoning submissions that are before, that are, actually if I take a step back, the review is being notified in stages, which means that not all of the land in the district has been notified at this point in time. An easy example is the industrial zones. They are being notified in the near future. Some submissions before you are seeking that their land be rezoned to an industrial zone. And they generally refer sometimes, well, they at times refer to a specific industrial zone. Other submissions are more general and just seek some type of industrial zone. And visitor accommodation subzone is also falls into the same category. So in these instances, it's the council's position that they do not want to have ad hoc industrial zones or visitor accommodation zones coming across into the proposed district plan via the submission process. That's not to say, that if there's merit in such a rezoning request that it is opposed in full, but the council's position is that these should be addressed by way of a variation in stage two. So what that would mean is if the council has got to a position where it agrees on the merits of that rezoning, that the council would re-notify that land with the industrial or physical accommodation rezoning in stage two, and then the submitter could submit in support of the rezoning or may wish to submit on the actual provisions of the zone that will be notified at the same time.
Can I just make sure I'm clear on what you're telling us here? Because it strikes me that if I put myself in the submitter's shoes, it's something of a catch-22, that if they let this chance to rezone their land go by, council may not choose to re-notify that land as subject to stage two, in which case the submitter will be met by a blank wall because their submission is then out of scope. I think that what you're telling me is that if this panel recommends a variation, for instance, to rezone a particular block of land subject to a visitor accommodation overlay or as an industrial zone, then the council will include that land in its stage two review, whether or not it agrees with this panel's views as to that zoning. But I think, but you'll understand it's quite important as to what the position is, so please tell me.
Yes, no, I hear what you were saying. I have given this some thought. And obviously the decision as to what is actually notified in a later stage must be made by the full council. However, it is the council officers that make all recommendations to the full council, and I submit and agree that the panel should be making recommendations that there be a, variation in stage two to that land. That would allow, as you have suggested, sir, and that would allow the submitter the assurance that it can essentially get the relief it's seeking through stage two. The process isn't perfect, but it is a consequence of the staged review, sir. What is important, and I hear what you're saying, is that They must be considered now by the panel because if they're not in stage two, there's a fair argument that you could say that they're not on stage two, and that's not fair process for those submitters and landowners.
How could we consider the merit of a spatial confirmation of, say, a visitor accommodation use in the absence of any of the provisions that would describe what that outcome might be? It sounds like an invitation for us to go into a path that officers have explicitly recommended we should reject when submitters have done it, which is to say something on that land, visitor accommodation-ish, would be okay. But we've got no idea what those provisions might be or what that detail might be or how the effects could be managed. How could we do that?
Some of the submitters have referred to and used the operative version of the zones, which I am aware the council is currently reviewing as to their appropriateness and is also looking at them at a district-wide level rather than just site-specific as these submitters are doing.
The council hasn't made any decisions, of course, yet, has it?
No, it hasn't.
So, for instance, it might just make a future visitor accommodation plan change apply to all land in the district, giving everyone the chance to have a fair bite of the cherry, informed with the facts of potential provisions. Is that something the council might... We don't know, of course, but has it made any decision whatsoever?
I can't ask, no. I don't know.
Because the chairperson's concern would only come into play if the council were minded to effectively pick winners here, here and here, and then use scope to stop anyone else. But if the council's not going to do that, it might not even be a problem.
I don't know what the council's going to do. Those recommendations
haven't
been made. It hasn't got that far in terms of its planning. In this hearing, what council officers have done is looked at the land in question and compared, for example, the notified zone with the type of zone being sought, whether it be three parks, industrial, visitor accommodation, and there are some examples where it says, yes, what the submission is saying, there is absolute merit to that, but we want the provisions, the considered provisions that we notify in stage two, to apply to it.
When I had a very similar conversation with you at the residential stream, your view then was that even though the specific provisions had been withdrawn, visitor accommodation was still, strictly speaking, provided for in all the zones, albeit as the catch-all, not provided for non-compliant activity status. So no one's actually faced with a prohibited activity, unless there are some specifically listed somewhere. That's still your understanding / view?
Yes, under the proposed district plan,
yep.
No activity is provided for, just to add that the default activity status is not always non-compliant across the zones.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Okay.
So I think that covers section 4. Moving to section 5, this is in relation to heritage submission. Sir, with your leave, I might just take you through this part of the submission, my submission, unless you would like to...
No, by all means, if you think that's important. Can I observe, though, we seem to have a terminology issue. As far as I'm aware, certainly when Commissioner McLeod was showing us around it, the block of trees on the hill above Kirimoko is known as Sticky Forest. I think you said it's the plantation, and I suppose I thought the plantation was on Plantation Road, and that was why it was Plantation Road, but that's by the by. My understanding is that forest is generally known to the locals as Sticky Forest, whatever it may historically have been known as. But can you clarify this so we are all on the same page? Because, for instance, I noticed that Ms. Nelson referred to it as Sticky Forest.
Yes, Mr. Barr might be better placed to do this, but the evidence from or for on behalf of Mr. Beresford refers to the subject area as Sticky Forest, and we have subsequently done the same in our rebuttal evidence and therefore in these legal submissions. That's a basic response to your question.
Sorry, Dad, have you just said the reverse? Because you just said you're referring to it as a plantation, as Mr. Barr does in his rebuttal.
Yes, we do refer to the plantation in the legal submission and the rebuttal, and in figure 2 of my rebuttal on page 22, I make the point of making the distinction between what is Sticky Forest and what is the plantation. But generally, as the word goes, if someone's going to go for a bike ride in the area, they're going to say Sticky Forest more than they'll say the plantation. But I wanted to make that distinction because some people are quite sensitive to that,
so that's the tension between the two. So, in summary, we should ask
the question. Well,
the question I've just posed.
Sir, I think.
Sensitive about that fact.
Yes, and as Mr. Barr correctly pointed out, we do refer to it as the plantation, which is the description he's used in his evidence. I think generally this area of land is called Sticky Forest, and it is sort of referred to in that way in various statements of evidence on behalf of Mr. Beresford and possibly in the council's evidence, I'm not sure.
Can I complicate things matter with figure 2 says that it's actually the plantation and Sticky Forest referring to both terminologies to the same thing? You've actually got figure 2, which is on page 22 of your rebuttal. You've got the subject site, which is the plantation, and just below it there's another definition, which is Sticky Forest. And it's sort of the whole site almost split into two. Does that make sense?
Well, they are separate sites too.
Yep.
So the Sticky Forest land is owned by, looking at that, 1, 2, 3, is under the ownership of 3 different landowners, and the large block of land to the north, which is part of Mr. Beresford's submission, is that what I'm trying to make the distinction is the plantation site. Yeah.
However. Okay.
Okay.
So no clear. I suppose the. So there's a mixture of terms, and I think that we need to be careful that we don't cause offence. So I think we've got that message.
So I'm referring to the plantation in terms of the scope of the rezoning request in the event.
Yep.
So the plantation is held by the Crown on trust for the descendants of the 57 original intended owners, who were to have had land transferred to them under the South Island Landless Natives Act, which I'll refer to as SILNA. Mr. Beresford is one of the beneficial owners and is part of a working group established by the Māori Land Court to create a more up-to-date beneficiary list and to investigate potential options for use of the site. Mr. Beresford explains in his evidence that title is anticipated to pass to the beneficiaries by the end of this year or early 2018. The plantation site was originally part of a larger title that was transferred by the Crown in the late 1990s to Ngāi Tahu Property Group and then subdivided in 1999, leaving the plantation without legal road access. It is currently planted in forestry and contains numerous mountain bike tracks used by the public and accessed from neighbouring public land. A key thread running through the submitted evidence and underlying the requested rezoning is that the Crown's purpose in transferring the plantation to the beneficial owners is to provide economic redress for past wrongs. The submitter therefore seeks a rezoning, a zoning that will provide economic benefits. The original release was for the 50 hectares to be rezoned to low density residential. This has subsequently been refined through the submitter's evidence and is now seeking rezoning of approximately 20 hectares of the south east portion of the site to a mix of large lot residential B and low density residential. The rural zone is requested to be retained over the remainder of the site, although this submitter seeks amendments to the ONL line. The council is sympathetic to the submitter and the beneficial owners, and conscious of the complex history described in the submitter's evidence. However, the council's position is that economic factors should not trump all other considerations in determining the most appropriate zoning for the site. The elements of part two of the RMA relating to Maori interests are strong directions to be borne in mind at every stage of the planning process, particularly sections 6E, 7A and 8. However, consideration of Tangata matters under sections 6, 7 and 8 do not trump other values that are relevant to achieving the purpose of the RMA. In these particular circumstances, section 6E is not relevant. Mr Crystal's evidence for the submitter explains that the block of land originally intended to be transferred under Silna was located at the neck between Lake Wanaka and Hawea. This land was later leased to a third party, and so the plantation was substituted for it under the Ngaitahu Settlement Act. Mr Crystal states at his paragraph 81 that the site is not considered to have any cultural values for beneficial owners, nor is it considered to be ancestral land. It is also submitted based on the same facts and logic that section 7A cannot be relevant in this instance. The plantation thus presents a somewhat unusual set of circumstances in that neither of the more specific provisions in section 6E or 7A are relevant when taking treaty principles into account under section 8. While section 8 requires the council to take treaty principles into account, it does not impose on the council the obligations of the Crown under the treaty.
Ms. Scott, before you go on, I read that proposition, which of course you could extract straight out of Brooker's, relying on Hanton. But Hanton seems like an eternity ago in the jurisprudence that relates to the treaty. Can you point to any more recent authority, like even within the last 10 years, that would support that proposition?
Not right now, sir, but I will look and come back to you on that.
Thank you.
Under the RMA, the Section 8 duty is to weigh the principles of the treaty with all other matters being considered, and in coming to a decision, effect a balance. All relevant matters must be identified and weighed. And Mr Barr has undertaken that weighing exercise in a thorough and careful manner, supported by expert council evidence in relation to landscape, traffic and infrastructure, and relying also on his own evidence on housing capacity.
Before you go on, do you think the proposition in the first sentence of 513 could stand against King Salmon? I thought balances were out of, I'm not sure what's in, but pretty sure that balances.
So I think the fact circumstances sitting behind King Salmon were very specific. It was talking about a situation where there was the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement that the council there had to give effect to. Used an avoidance policy, which essentially meant to prohibit. And, well, as you know, I'm sure, sir, but the circumstances of that case and the principle that has come out of it is somewhat different to what we are considering here.
But the Supreme Court did give us some guidance on how to read part two.
Yes, it did, and section 8 is about taking into account as well.
So your answer in brief is that you can distinguish King Salmon?
Yes, that's correct, sir.
Thank you.
At paragraph 515, so Mr. Barr has gone to, in his evidence, the Tangata Whenua chapter, chapter 5, and also the operative Otago regional policy statement. He notes that the latter is both are framed in terms of giving effect to section 6E, as are the relevant parts of chapter 3. They are directed at section 6E and at consultation. Mr. Barr acknowledges the relevant parts of the proposed regional policy statement are more directive in terms of requiring district plans to have regard to settlement land. That policy statement is, of course, under appeal. He's also considered benefits that would arise from having regard to treaty principles, and his view is that economic benefit to the beneficial owners should not outweigh other relevant parts of consideration. The Council submits that Mr. Barr's approach is correct and that he is entitled to give weight to other Part 2 matters, including the protection of ONLs from inappropriate subdivision, use and development, which is Section 16 matter, roading and infrastructure issues.
Can I ask you, while I could understand that submission as the relief was originally framed, given that the Beresford relief has been pulled back to within, well, outside the ONL line as Ms. Malsop now recommends it to be, is this still a Section 6B issue? And if it's not, where do roading and infrastructure issues fit into Part 2?
I believe, and I might need to ask Mr. Barr this, but it becomes a Section 7 matter in terms of the specific or the refined relief that Beresford are seeking, because it does sit outside the ONL. There is, I believe, the alternative relief does still relate to within that ONL. They are seeking some allowance for activities within the ONL. I recall, in terms of infrastructure, sir, you are correct. I believe Mr. Ulrich's rebuttal evidence has acknowledged the refined relief, I believe. I believe he doesn't oppose that revised relief.
The revised relief sought still the effects on the ONL, given the proximity of urban development to it, and the overall scheme, which very respected experts can take questions on, sir.
Okay.
But there is also there are, I think, two building restriction areas located directly adjacent to these parts, the part that's still been sought to be rezoned, which Mr. Barr has also taken into account. So where we've landed, in terms of the Council's recommendations, is an amendment to the ONL boundary, but still rural zone in terms of the most appropriate. At paragraph 5.20, I mentioned there that if the panel is minded to accept the rezoning, Mr. Barr has recommended limiting the urban zoning and extension of the urban growth boundary to a reduced area of land, as is recommended by the Council's landscape expert. And that is the building restriction areas that I've just mentioned, the interaction with the development restrictions placed on adjacent rezoned land would also require careful consideration by the panel in order to ensure there was consistent treatment of similar factors and resources.
We'll break for after a second, but I have one question for you to ponder arising and to advise me of your view arising out of the Beresford submission. One of the quirks of the relief sought by Mr. Beresford on behalf of Mr. Beresford is that forestry is a prohibited activity in the LGR zone, which would be the ultimate own goal. Getting a zone that we couldn't then get rid of the trees. And Mr. Crystal is, of course, conscious of that and has recommended that that aspect of the residential zone rules governing LDRs be amended as it relates to that block of land. The question for you, given the submission sought an LDR rezoning, is the amendment, is the further amendment to the LDR zone rules within scope? So you could have to think about that over afternoon tea, and we'll be back at 10:04.
I can answer it now if you'd like to.
You could ask if you've got an answer for me now, then by all means.
The answer is an amendment to the LDR zone rules will be within scope if that amendment sits somewhere between the notified zone and the zone that they're pursuing. So it can't be anything more extreme than LDR, but if it's somewhere between rural and the notified version of LDR, then there's scope to make that change.
Indeed. But this is, I would understand that completely if this was making the LDR zone as sought more restrictive, but this is making it more enabling. Altering what is currently a prohibited activity rule into something more enabling. In fact, I think they're saying it might even be permitted.
Yes, so that falls into there is no scope. It's on the other side of the line. That would be the council's submission today.
Thank you. We'll adjourn until 10:04, and if Mr. Faulkner has arrived by then, we'll start with him and break into your submission. That's okay with you.
Absolutely. Thank you.